I'm Christian. I'm a unit manager of a residential mental health service. I'm a qualified mental health nurse, and I've been working in healthcare for the past 30 years or so.
Now, can you just give us an idea of the number of people in the unit and the sort of day-to-day work that you're doing?
Yes, it's around 40 people that we look after. These are people with long-term mental health problems. So they're kind of they're within our service, and we look after them in their own homes. It's not like a hospital unit. We have staff who kind of live in with some people to an extent. They sleep in overnight in the people's homes, or they do kind of daily visits, that sort of thing.
Okay, and what are your responsibilities?
Well, to manage that service overall, to ensure that we're adequately staffed and that people's sort of needs are met on a daily basis, whether that be sort of access to medication, social inclusion activities, getting out and about, that sort of thing, and just general activities of daily living. We don't provide personal care on the scheme like you would have in a nursing home or a residential home.
So can you also give us an idea of the age range?
Yeah, we call them working age adults, but we don't really have any upper age limit. We work with people for as long as we can in terms of whether we can meet their needs. If someone becomes frail and needs personal care, we could still continue to work with them if they had a different package of care coming in. But it might be that people have to move off the scheme if their needs become more complex. So we don't have an upper age limit, and I'd say we wouldn't take anyone under 18, and our sort of average age, I think, works out around about in the mid-50s.
Now, look, Christian, you've been doing this a long time, and there's been enormous cuts, particularly to local government, but also to the NHS, many of the NHS services over that time, particularly since the 2008 bailouts. Can you just give us an idea of how that's impacted on you and what you do?
Well, I think it's led my workforce to feel under almost, constant threat that there won't be a service anymore. There's certainly been a move within local authorities in general to just be purchasers of care rather than providers. So a service like ours that would be kind of, run as part of a local authority, they become less and less common as they've been kind of moved up onto the private sector or the voluntary sector. So we've managed to kind of keep going as part of our local council. But it has meant that, the service is often under scrutiny, and well, like any other service, where they would be looking for efficiency savings and looking to sort of reduce the overall spend of the council. Generally speaking, social care tends to, people acknowledge that that's one of the services that shouldn't be cut back on, say in comparison to libraries, sports centres, things like that. But it does mean that over the past 10 years or so, or more, in fact, yeah, that it's... The sort of atmosphere is one of the service may not continue, may have to move towards privatisation or some sort of cooperative endeavour, that kind of thing.
Well, it's not very good for morale, is it? That sort of thing. And there's been another potential blow to morale. It'd be interesting to see what you think, as the announcement is made that by next April, all healthcare workers that are public sector anyway in the UK, and maybe you can clarify that for us, are going to have to be vaccinated, double vaccinated, or I suppose it might even be triple vaccinated by next April, or lose their jobs. Now, there are some potential problems and pitfalls with this. not only if you know people have had adverse reactions to vaccines in the past, but anyway, how has that affected the people you're working with and you yourself?
Well, at this stage, I mean, my service isn't CQC registered. That's the Care Quality Commission. It's a sort of a regulatory body that oversees inspections of care homes. Now, care workers in that sector, since the 11th of this month, have already been required to be double vaccinated. So that legislation came in first. And whilst that was coming in, they were then considering it for healthcare workers. So, it's not been specific to my services yet, but I can sort of see it coming. That I've had to sort of respond to requests for information about whether my staff are vaccinated or not, and how many of our service users are vaccinated, and that sort of thing.
Well, that isn't really normal, is it? I mean, what can I ask you? Roughly, what proportion of your staff have got vaccinated? So I imagine this would be quite a big talking point amongst them.
Not really, no. Most of them are vaccinated. I think there's generally people of a lot of the information that people take in is just very very geared towards getting yourself vaccinated. That's the thing to do. It's for everyone's safety and benefit, and it's a way of getting our freedoms back. I personally don't see it quite the same way. I'm not vaccinated, and I won't be getting vaccinated. But yeah, the majority of my staff are. So it's not really been an issue in that sense. In that, my managers are fairly satisfied that it's not really going to be an issue. I suspect it might become an issue if the status of being fully vaccinated changes at some point to having had to have had a booster. So I think people may become more hesitant over time, even if they've got the first two doses of vaccine, as to whether it's something they're going to want to continue.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can remember as a youngster getting a vaccine generally meant that was just a one-off thing that you'd have to do rather than something that was repeated year after year. And let's also not forget that there's considerable doubts about the flu vaccine, which was an annual vaccine, as to whether it was actually really effective or not. So anyway, what the main question's got to be, Christian, why have you decided not to? What's the reason?
Well, I believe I've had COVID. So this was early on. In fact, it was December 2019, before it was really a talking point in this country, and just when the first information was coming out of Wuhan, really.
Hang on, because in December, COVID effectively didn't exist, because it wasn't until really January 2020 that we started hearing stories even about Wuhan. So you were even before that. Yeah. And anyway, also, how do you know you had it or not?
Well, symptom wise, and then I sort of had some follow up symptoms in January, some inflammation of my toe, chilblains, and it could have been unrelated. But in terms of the symptoms that were being talked about, there's a possibility that I had it. I did have an antibody test. I didn't show positive for antibodies. But then again, not everyone who's had COVID has done. So I think it would be very difficult now to establish whether I'd had it or not. The main test you would have is the antibody test. There are tests for T-cell immunity, although those are more expensive tests. But it's kind of, in terms of if I'm required to get vaccinated, it really won't make a difference whether I think I've had it or not, because the approach the government seems to have taken is that natural immunity isn't sufficient. It's not sufficient to allow you to work in the health sector. it's not sufficient to allow you to use the COVID pass. So it's kind of a moot point, really. But yeah, I feel I have had it, but I don't, you know, I can't say 100% that I have. I had a flu-like illness in the latter part of 2019, and I'm aware there's some evidence that, you know, that part of the SARS-CoV-2 genome was detected in wastewater in I think in Spain in kind of I think halfway through 2019. So there have certainly been coronaviruses around for some time, and other sort of iterations of SARS. So who knows? But
I mean, I think if you've had high temperature, you've had coughs. I mean, I'm no doctor, but I would suggest, you know, if you've had a really bad cough, you had a high temperature, all that sort of thing, that you probably have had it. But the fact I've lost count. It's at least 30 or 40 people I've spoken to here in the Southwest who said that they had these symptoms end of December, beginning of January. That's 2019, 2020. So it was definitely circulating around Bristol at that time, around this, you know, it's the Southwest generally. And quite a few people have pointed to the fact that our figures later in the year, sort of the middle of the year, were, you know, in this part of the country, were very low, suggesting that maybe it had already raged through quite a large proportion of society. But look, you know, this whole business of testing is quite important, isn't it? So that people like you don't know whether you've had it or not. And yet, if you look at where the testing kicked in, it was pretty much after the first wave had finished. So as the curve goes up, and it goes up in April and May, and it starts to fall down in June and July 2020. And it was only August, September, that we started to really get mass testing. So it may be that there are millions and millions, maybe even tens of millions of people that have had COVID, but then have also had the vaccine. So you're not, you know, we wouldn't be necessarily on your own if you did have it. But anyway, look, what's your reasoning about not having this? Because, I mean, surely it doesn't make any difference whether you had it before or not. It can't do you any harm to have the vaccine, can it?
I feel that it potentially could. So that's a risk I wouldn't want to take. Prior to sort of doing my nurse training, my academic background was in philosophy and sociology, and particularly medical sociology, philosophy of science, history of science. And back then, I looked into some of the facts and figures around the development of vaccines. And I would say back in those days, it was almost a sort of well-known area of study that you'd use to demonstrate the fact that, you know, science was a human endeavor that was affected by things such as, you know, economics and sort of industrial and military applications, that sort of thing. And one of the pieces of evidence to show that things aren't always as the medical profession or the pharmaceutical industry might tell us is that if you look at the history of vaccination, vaccines tend to claim way too much credit for decline in infectious disease. I'm not saying they don't have a role, but compared to all other public health measures like sanitation, improved housing, nutrition, you know, a lot of those infectious diseases, well, all of them really were in decline way before vaccination sort of came into its own. And along the way, I mean, smallpox is often held up by people as one of the real successes of vaccination. And it has been in terms of the eradication of smallpox. And that's unless it still exists in some lab somewhere ready to leak out. But it's, you know, during the history of the development of that particular vaccine, there were lots of deaths and injuries along the way that would appear to be attributable to the to the vaccine. There were spikes in infection that went along with the with vaccination programs. So I developed a degree of skepticism early on, I would say, many years ago, when it wasn't when it seemed to be acceptable to have alternative views on vaccination. It's and you know, I've throughout my career, I don't feel I've needed vaccinations to be able to do my job. I think if I'd worked in surgery, exposure prone procedures, I may well have had a hepatitis B vaccine. I think if I worked in a sort of high occupational risk like forestry or something, I might well have a tetanus jab. But overall, and I, you know, I had a range of vaccines when I was a young child. I had no real say in the matter then. But in my adult life, I've seen no reason to have a yearly flu vaccination. Ultimately, no matter how safe and effective a vaccine might be, and there are big questions around the veracity of the information that comes out about those. But even if a vaccine was completely safe and effective, it should still be my body, my choice. Really, that's a fundamental principle of healthcare is that we promote choice and we respect the choices that people make.
Yeah, but it might not be your choice. I mean, we might get to the stage, you know, next year where you're told either you get yourself a vaccine, Christian, or you lose your job.
Yeah, well, I won't be getting a vaccine, so at that point we'll have to see. I mean, as I say, the legislation has come into force for care workers, and it's interesting the way that was done. Although they're saying health, NHS and the social care sector will have to be vaccinated by the 1st of April, it's yet to go through Parliament. And again, it's interesting to see in such a diverse sector, such a large employer, quite exactly how they'll manifest it. I mean, will they do large scale contract changes for everyone? Will they? I think they've got their fingers crossed that people are going to be threatened and bullied into it. I think it will be interesting when it comes down to it for each individual who does say no and does mean no as to what will happen to them. Will they be redeployed to another role elsewhere? How far will that extend? What level of exemption will they accept?
Well, I suppose the government are saying that people actually are being threatened and bullied for their own good because they don't understand the science. People like you don't understand the science.
That is the approach the government appear to be taking. It seems very disingenuous wrong. This idea that there is somehow a settled science on anything really, because that's not how science works. There isn't any room for debate on safety and efficacy of the vaccines. It's ridiculous. The world seems to have changed quite a lot in the past couple of years in terms of what you're allowed to think and say about these things.
So what do you think's going on? Why is there been this change of attitude saying, well, actually, we're telling you what to stick in your body and what you don't, and if you don't do what we tell you, you're going to lose your job?
I do think it's based on this idea of a COVID pass, from the point of view of a biosecurity threat. ID cards, digital ID cards have been tried before by other governments, and they've never been that popular in this country. And we seem to have resisted them, and it seems to me like a way of leading into that. If you make it about the the vaccine and health, and you know, like I say, why wouldn't people want to be safe and look after themselves and others? But then, if the upshot of that is that we all have to kind of participate in a digital ID database, then it's kind of a route into that. I feel I don't, you know, they'll. That doesn't necessarily mean it's been all engineered in towards that, and that doesn't, you know, it would be difficult to say that that's what this is all about. Whether it's a crisis that's been seen as an opportunity, you know, it's one way of looking at it, or you know, whether there were kind of elements of planning to go into it, it's difficult. But yeah, I see a kind of I see that it's about more than just being. It's certainly more than about just immunity, because this really odd idea is that people, you know, you've still got to get the vaccine anyway. Like, natural immunity is not going to be sufficient, and that's just so unscientific. That it beggars belief, really.
Well, but it does. I mean, we've had various doctors, including Dr. Stanley Laham, the retired immunologist from Florida, explaining that your body's immunity to SARS-CoV-2, whatever the variant it is way, way better than that the vaccine gives you, because the vaccine only gives you an immunity to one area on the outside of this virus to recognize it, whereas your body's immune system recognizes the whole thing. And so the variants really don't stand a chance with your own immune system, but they do when it comes to vaccines. They just basically go around the vaccine and yeah. Mutate. So there seems to be some sort of really bad science at the bottom of this.
Yeah. And that kind of feeds into the whole problem around infection and transmission as well, because these vaccines, they are a novel technology, and yeah, the way they work is quite different to previous vaccines that you know, perhaps would afford a measure of protection from getting infected, and I think, you know, the manufacturers have pointed out that these vaccines are about mitigating symptoms. They're not about reducing infection transmission. But the whole basis of the COVID pass and having restrictions for the unvaccinated as opposed to the vaccinated, it can only be based on the idea that you're somehow not, you know, going to get infected or not going to be transmitting a virus. And really, there's nothing about the mechanism of these mRNA or viral vector vaccines that means that you'll be any less contagious.
Yeah, interesting. So anyway, Christian, you're going to be labelled an anti-vaxxer, aren't you?
Yeah, but I'm okay with that. I would say on balance, I would have to say that I am. That doesn't, but you know, it's weird. We've got people now, you know, who've spent their lives in the development of vaccines who are being labelled anti-vaxxers. Professor Robert Malone, Dr. Mike Eden, people who, you know, they'd be at pains to say, well, I'm not, how can I be an anti-vaxxer? But it's become a label that can be applied to people. And yeah, I fear it's a way of, marking someone out as a dissident or an extremist, even. Whereas, as I say, when I was, you know, many years ago when I first started to kind of get into healthcare, it was okay to have these debates. It was okay to have different views on things and to acknowledge that there was a degree of complexity and nuance, particularly in medicine as a branch of science, and well, particularly psychiatry. Yeah, which is my field.
When I was doing my degree, it was thought to be extremely good to be a dissident. Nowadays, apparently, it's a terrible thing to be. But, you know, there's definitely been some sort of change in attitude, and science, you know, if it can't be discussed and debated, it's not science. Simple as that.
Absolutely.
I would also add, look, I mean, you know, I guess I'm an anti-vaxxer now, you know, because I've seen so much propaganda being put out about this, and it's effectively like the mass media, including news bulletins, etc., have been used as a marketing tool for vaccines. So effectively using those news bulletins to pillory scientists and individuals, campaigners who are trying to put a different point of view about, you know, the potential that this experiment on the humans may not be such a good idea, as well as to actually promote all sorts of different pseudo reasons why someone should have an experimental injection into their arm, doesn't seem to me to fulfill any of the proper criteria that I was taught in mainstream broadcasting, state broadcasting, public service broadcasting, as balanced journalism. It's more like marketing. So I'm in this silly situation now of thinking, well, actually, I don't think I ever want a vaccine again, you know, after what I've seen at this latest iteration, because things have definitely changed in the way that journalism's being done, particularly since the late 80s, early 1990s. You know, we've seen a lot more of this kind of promotion through news bulletins, virtue signalling, this kind of thing. But anyway, look, I'll leave the final word to you, Christian. What advice have you got for people who are thinking about succumbing? I suppose thinking, well, you know, eventually I'm going to have this vaccine if I want to see my loved ones abroad, go on holiday, keep my job.
I would never judge any individual on what decision they take, because you don't know you know what goes into that for each individual. But I would like to think that people look at the evidence. It's actually getting very, very difficult to, you know, there's such a profusion of information and misinformation and stuff that can't really be verified, that maybe I'd just say to people, trust your gut instinct and don't be bullied. But, you know, that's with the caveat that, yeah, no, people have lives, they have families, mortgages. I can't guide people in any particular way, but trust your gut instinct, because there's a lot of strange stuff going on. That's how it feels.
Yeah, maybe the lunatics are not just in the mental health unit. Maybe they're running the show.
When we just first started to see on the news about, you know, what was happening in China and Italy, people started to mention the words lockdown. And that sort of irritated me at first, because lockdown was a term that I'd been familiar with when I'd worked in forensic psychiatry and worked on a secure unit. And lockdown was something that you did for a particular purpose for a limited period of time, to, you know, whether to sort of search someone's room for weapons or something like that. And then I'd sort of heard the term start to be used a bit more I think on the TV series 24, got mentioned quite a lot. And then it started to come through in popular culture a bit, sort of in pop songs and things. So I was just hearing it more and more over the years. And then people just started using the term as if it was a thing. And then, of course, it did happen. And that's what everyone was calling it. It was quite odd for my service users, for the people that we look after in our scheme, because there are people with long-term mental health problems, often with a long history of being in a hospital setting and having to sort of live with various restrictions. And a big part of our work in a very slow and steady way is to sort of bring them out of that and to get them back into activities and to become part of their community and sort of be out and about. And all of a sudden, there was very little we could do with the people we work with. obviously we had to carry on working. It wasn't none of us were sort of furloughed, and you know, we just had to keep doing what we were doing, and we couldn't really make our workplaces particularly COVID safe, as it were, in the same way as other workplaces. And there was very limited sort of access to PPE to start with. I think we did get hold of some sort of masks and gloves and those sort of things. But in general, working in people's homes, that wasn't really just appropriate to be going around the house in those things. So yeah, basically what happened was that we were unable to do very much other than sort of just be there and maybe go out and do shopping for people and actually, you know, do things for people, where our main ethos would always be helping people to do things for themselves. And what I would say is that a lot of our service users took very well to lockdown. There wasn't, it wasn't an increase in anxiety necessarily. It was quite easy to just kind of passively accept that, right, this is what's happening. But then as things started to open up again, it felt like for some people, years and years of work had been undone for people who'd found it actually quite difficult to kind of get out and about and do things. And we were then in a position of sort of not back to square one necessarily, but that you know, the kind of the whole thrust of our work had sort of been put back quite a few steps.
Sorry, could you just give us an example of how, you know, it you know, directly how it affected maybe just a, you know, specific person without naming them?
Okay. Well, I mean, at the moment we've got someone who became quite ill. This is following her second vaccination. She went off her medication and became mentally unwell quite quickly. I'm not saying that was due to the vaccine. It just sort of happened at that time. But then she also developed pneumonia and was in hospital for quite a while. Now, that's turned into a much lengthier episode of care than we'd have expected. And that's been to do with sort of restrictions on our staff being able to visit the hospital and to kind of get involved in that sort of rehabilitation work to get her back to doing things. And then, so now she's had to go from hospital to a care home, and we're in the sort of same position of trying to do what we do, which is sort of based on that relationship we built up with someone and being able to encourage them to do things. And that's made quite difficult by the restrictions of, say, the hospital and the care home, and having to fit around that. It's in her case in particular, it's slowed down her recovery really quite significantly.
So are these restrictions still in place now?
Yes. It's not the same as when, you know, in the early days of lockdown, it was quite noticeable, you know, how little traffic there was, that sort of thing. We've come a long way past that. But in terms of visiting sort of hospital wards, medical centres, and now nursing homes, you know, visiting procedures are still quite restrictive, we find. I'm not sure. That may be different in different areas of the country. I don't know, but it seems that there's a, you know, in terms of like normal, you know, cinemas, supermarkets, those sort of things, they've felt like they've gone back to normal in more recent months. But I would say it hasn't felt the same in healthcare facilities.
Okay, Christian, well, stay in touch. Let us know how you get on if push comes to shove.
Okay, will do. Thank you very much, Tony.